And I'm going to ask Ms. Chin Kaplan if she has a redirect. Do the special masters have any questions?
Yes. I do.
Special Master Vowell has some questions.
Do you want to go first?
Okay.
Doctor, would you look at your slides? And I just have a couple questions, one at least about the slide. And that is, on page 3 of your slide, you refer to the products of the innate immune system, and you refer to something called NO. But you didn't define that for us.
Yeah, that's nitric oxide.
Okay.
It's a mediator of inflammation.
Got it. All right. And I may be misquoting you, so please correct me. I thought you testified, and this was far long ago, that effector T cells provide immunity. Is that what you said?
Correct.
Could you explain that to me?
Okay. An effector T cell is one that has gone from being naive, has matured, has become activated, and is now armed and ready to destroy infected cells.
Okay.
There's also effector T cells that differentiate into the Th1 and Th2 types that secrete different cytokines to help arm, in the case of Th2, B lymphocytes, activate them to produce antibodies, and in the case of the CD8 cells, turn them into the cytotoxic T lymphocyte, which is then the effector cell of the cell-mediated immune.
So do we have any particular term we use for an effector T cell that is involved in the process of providing immunity as opposed to...
So examples of effector T cells involved in immunity would be the CD4,
CD8.
CD8.
Okay. All right, then moving back to your slide, and this is your cell picture, so page 15. When the genes, the N, P, M, F, H, and L, are produced, do you need all of those genes before a protein is made, or will the N gene encode a particular protein?
The N gene will encode a particular protein?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So you could get proteins produced within the cell if you only had the N gene replicated?
Correct. But you wouldn't get F protein off the N gene.
All right. And when you are, but what you are measuring in PCR is the genes themselves, not the protein.
Correct.
Okay. And you testified on cross-examination about some knowledge about the interactions both in the United Kingdom between universities or government entities and private firms and within the United States. Is that correct?
Yes.
Does the term CRADA mean anything to you?
Yes.
Okay. Do they have in the United Kingdom CRADAs?
Not per se. What they do is, instead of the companies going outside and supporting, so they bypass the government in their situation. So the companies will specifically support laboratories.
All right. So that there is not that linkage that we have within our system.
Correct.
Now, I hate to get back into... And CRADA would be, it's
now,
an
that was
acronym.
As of 2002.
Okay, and it may
so
have changed.
It may.
And I noticed that my colleague has asked me to spell CRADA, and it's CRADA. It's an acronym. All right. I hate to go back there in one sense, but in your report, when you talked about the high level in, and I'm leaving the object there blank within Michelle. Can you explain to me what specifically you are referring to?
It is the copper, it's the copy number I'm referring to. The amount of RNA that's present.
Okay.
And it's measured as an amount per volume.
An amount per volume of what?
Of RNA that they pick off the standard curve.
Okay. And does that amount, is that amount dependent on the amount of time in the replicator?
No.
Okay.
The amount is dependent, so everything is set at a threshold. The amount is dependent on the standard curve.
So you plug something into the standard, you plug the results into the standard curve, and that tells you.
You have to find a straight line portion of the standard curve.
Okay.
So that's why you do different dilutions or different amounts. You find a point on the straight line, and that then tells you the amount that's present.
Okay. Let's suppose, and I'm going to pick on folks here, Mr. Conway has an active measles viral infection, and we take some tissue from his body. And we measure the amount of measles virus RNA through a PCR method. Are you saying that the level in Michelle was higher than someone with an active, than Mr. Conway with an active measles virus infection?
Yes.
Okay.
With the caveat, in Mr. Conway, you're not measuring his gut.
Okay. Well, let's not even assume that we're measuring his gut. All right. We won't go there, Mr. Conway.
Anything but the gut.
Are you volunteering for a brain biopsy? I don't think so. All right. So, would it matter then what tissue we were measuring? You've talked about.
No, it wouldn't. That would be considered a high level.
Okay.
An amplified level.
And it wouldn't matter how much tissue we started with because you're using standard dilutions.
Correct.
So it would mean that there was a high amount, there was a high viral load. Is that correct? Would that be a correct term?
Yes.
Okay, I think I have it now. Thank you.
Further, sort of related to Special Master Vowell's question, you indicated several times during direct examination that you were surprised. You would not have expected to have found replicating measles virus in the gut.
Correct.
Is there some place you might have expected to find replicating measles virus?
In this particular individual or in general?
I'm asking you. It was your testimony.
Okay. So, no, I wouldn't expect to find it in the gut of this individual. I would have expected that the immune response would have taken care of that and he wouldn't see it. In an individual who has a natural infection, you can find it at various sites, and it depends on the cycle. So the measles virus has a specific cycle, how it infects a host. It's got a viremia stage where it's found in the blood. It's got a droplet stage on how it can be spread through coughing and upper respiratory. You can potentially isolate it from the lesions that occur as the result of an active measles virus infection. So depending on the site, you can get amounts, but I wouldn't anticipate on what's been reported to see the amount that you saw in Michelle at any one of those sites.
Okay, your answer there almost anticipates my next question, where you didn't expect to see it. You talked about the blood. And I was going to ask, based on what you what was discovered, what is alleged to have been discovered in the gut tissue here, would you expect to find the presence of measles virus in blood cells?
Not necessarily.
That depends on the stage.
Depends on the stage. And viremia could have been cleared, the virus could be gone, but it's persisting somewhere else. And because it's there, that's another one of my arguments for persistence. If you found it in the blood, then it would be still trying to find its place. going to other places.
Okay, one more, just to be certain that I understand this piece. In a normal, meaning normally operating with whatever range that means for an immune system, you would expect a natural virus to be cleared, or at least to be cleared entirely, or to be cleared to the extent that it could not be detected. It either didn't exist or could no longer be detected, even by PCR methods.
Cleared such that it couldn't be detected.
So it's possible that you could still have some remnant.
It's possible.
Okay. Even in a normally operating.
It's possible.
Okay.
But the studies have not really looked at that to say, if you can't detect it, the assumption is it's clear. But if you can't detect it, is it because you're not sensitive enough, or is it because it's not there?
Thank you.
And just let me clarify.
Yes.
For the type of viruses that measles virus is grouped in, it is virologic dogma that once you mount an effective immune system, immune response, and it's no longer there, that it is cleared. Gone.
Thank you.
Put the new sensitive techniques in, it may throw that dogma out.
Got it.
All right, Ms. Chin Kaplan, you had some redirect for this witness. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Master. Dr. Kennedy, you asked a series of questions about the meeting that took place in the United Kingdom. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did you identify the people who were present at that meeting?
Yes, I did, to the best of my knowledge.
And could you just remind the court who they were?
So, Dr. Richard Tedder, who's a professor of clinical virology from the UK, myself, Dr. John Marshallonis, Dr. Orla Shields, Dr. Stephen Jacobson, who's a branch chief at National Institutes of Neurologic Disorders and Stroke, a pediatrician who I can't remember, and a couple other individuals from the UK, Ireland, who were molecular biology expertise that I would have to dig back and remember who they were.
And you also indicated that you grilled Dr. Shields for about 4 hours. Is that what you stated?
Yeah, 4.5 hours. Okay. We made her cranky.
When you say you grilled her, did you question her about the procedure that subsequently constituted the Ullman paper?
There were several of us that went in with the opinion of the null hypothesis. We don't believe your data. Prove it to us.
And
so we took a very strong ground and made her show and try to convince us that this was indeed what was going on.
And when you said that you tried to make her show that this was what's going on, did you ask her questions about whether cross-contamination could occur?
Yes.
And what was her response to that?
That she deals with cross-contamination the way that most laboratories do. She has a standard operating procedure. If she sees cross-contamination, the run is invalid, nullified. She tries to figure out where the cross-contamination occurred, and the laboratory is set up in that isolation takes place in one area, the actual PCR reaction takes place in another, and the analysis takes place in a third.
So the possibility of cross-contamination, after she explained that to you, how would you characterize the possibility of cross-contamination?
We didn't feel that cross-contamination was an issue relative to the data that she was showing us in the final analysis.
Did you ask her about this issue of controls?
Yes.
And what specifically did you ask her?
Everything.
When you say everything, could you state to the court what everything is?
Why did you not run a no-template control?
And what was the response?
We ran a no-template control. When you publish your PCR data, do you put that you ran a no-template control in your materials and methods section?
And what other questions did you ask her?
Asked her things like, what were your controls for your primers? How did you determine whether something was positive? Why did you substitute in your consensus sequence a T for a C because that would lower the potential melting curve and cause some issues. She explained that.
And what was her response to that?
That she was looking for allelic discrimination, that this was an easy way to show the difference between wild-type measles virus and the vaccine strain.
And were you satisfied with that explanation?
Absolutely, because she showed us sequence data on the primer products that suggested it was directly related to vaccine strain.
And you indicated earlier that, correct me if I'm wrong, that they had found vaccine strain in the F gene, was that it?
Yes, that's where they looked for the allelic discriminator.
And is that specific to vaccine strain?
The primers that they used for that particular thing, yes.
And Doctor, when you address the issue of controls, were you satisfied that every positive that was supposed to be positive was positive, and every negative that was supposed to be negative was negative?
Yes.
And Doctor,
was I positive with her interpretation of when something was positive versus negative from a standpoint of overall? We had a lot of discussion about that.
And did some of that discussion involve copy numbers?
No, when we talked about copy numbers and she had high-level copy numbers, that was not a concern. It was when she was stretching the limits of sensitivity of the assay and trying to pick up these very low copy numbers that there was a lot of discussion on what she determined was a positive result versus a negative result.
And what did you consider a low copy number?
Anything that was below 1,000.
Doctor, I'm going to show you a lab result from Petitioner's Exhibit 28, page 179. Doctor, would you take a look at this document and tell me what this document represents?
It's a report on measles virus detection from Uni Genetics Limited. It's from Michelle Cedillo.
And what's the date on this?
The date of the test is 15-03-02, so that'd be March 15-02.
And does this test indicate that measles virus was detected in this ileal biopsy?
Yes.
What was the copy number that was obtained?
1.67 times 10 to the fifth copies per nanogram of total volume.
Would that be considered, how would you characterize that copy number?
I would consider that high.
And Doctor, you had previously testified that there was no dispute among the participants present at this meeting that high copy numbers were accurate?
We had no issues when she had high copy numbers.
Doctor, you also indicated that Dr. Shields said she found some N protein, was that it?
Yes. The group presented data on immunohistochemistry where they identified M protein present in the biopsies. And these were from children that had autistic enterocolitis. In addition, they provided some data from some individuals of the presence of measles virus RNA in cerebrospinal fluid.
And Doctor, the presence of M protein, if we go to your chart on page 15, we've now gone through N gene, P gene, F gene, and H gene, correct? And we're now down in the green part here, correct? And does that mean that we have replicating virus here?
Yes.
Do you have protein present?
In my assessment, yes.
And Doctor, You've reviewed the report of respondent's expert, Diane Griffin, have you not?
Yes, I have.
And, Doctor, do you recall whether Dr. Griffin indicated that if protein was present, then it's an indication that it's replicating and spreading to other tissues?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to look at, I'll bring you over, Respondents Exhibit V, page 7, number 2 on that page. Would you kindly read that into the record, please?
Okay, this is from page 7. It says that viral protein production is also necessary for virus to replicate and for new virions to be made. Without this, there can be no virus replication and no spread of virus within the host to other cells or tissues.
When you read that statement, Doctor, is Dr. Griffin indicating that if there are proteins present, the virus is replicating?
Yes, that's how I read that statement. Since Dr. Griffin's the expert, I'm certainly not going to question anything that she says. I believe Dr. Griffin has over 100 publications in measles virus.
So, Doctor, at the end of this meeting, what conclusions did the group come to?
We were satisfied with the results of the O'Leary and Shields laboratory. We felt that they were competent, that they were capable. They did not find, in every instance where they looked, measles virus. In some instances, in some individuals, they found measles virus. So that made us feel a lot better in that it wasn't found in every instance. And in runs that they would run, they would have a positive individual and a negative individual. So that argued there was no cross-contamination, there was no issue relative to that, and we felt fairly assured that this was a very competent laboratory, that they were skilled at what they did, that they were aware of the problems with PCR, and that their conclusions were supported for the presence of measles virus in gut biopsies and in the instance where it was found in cerebrospinal fluid.
Thank you, Doctor.
Mr. Madnaski, any recross?
Yes, sir, briefly.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm just taking a look at a document, and unfortunately, it's very small print. Hello again, Dr. Kennedy.
How are you?
In the exhibit that you were asked to look at, the results from Unigenetics reported on Michelle Cedillo, was there any positive result for protein measles virus protein?
In that document, no.
Your discussion about positive results for protein is based on the representations of Dr. Shields at a meeting?
Yes.
Did you see any of the actual lab reports?
Actually saw some lab reports and data, and we questioned her with regards to the use of the specific reagents that she was performing the immunohistochemistry with. One reagent in particular, we felt as a group, was very problematic. It was a polyclonal antibody to the measles virus that was used, and there was a concern that that polyclonal antibody had issues related to cross-reactivity and may not be detecting measles virus protein. She addressed this by providing us with information that they used four different monoclonal antibodies in addition to the polyclonal that were specific for epitopes on the measles virus N protein. And we felt confident with the monoclonal antibody that that dealt with the issue that we as a group had over the concern of them using a polyclonal antibody.
In terms of presenting this to you, she told you about it?
No, we actually saw data.
Okay. Did you go to the lab?
No, I did not.
Did you look at the lab notebooks?
Yes, I did.
They had all of them?
They had, I want to say, at least four or five boxes. I didn't look at every individual one and every individual page, but there were certain ones that I was interested in, certain ones that other in the group were interested in, and we looked at what our interest was and then discussed that later on in comparison. What did we find? Were we satisfied? Was there control? When was this run? What was the primer set? We were concerned about where they ordered their primers, when they ran out of primers, what was the source of their TAC polymerase, where did they specific, a lot of us not being from the UK, didn't know where they got the specific reagents to isolate the RNA, were there issues related to that, sample preparation. So it was a pretty rigorous go at. I had a look at specific aspects that made me feel comfortable that in the instances that I was looking for, that the notebooks were a true representation of the data that she presented to us in June.
Okay, so from your point of view, you had a good idea of what was going on.
Yes.
And this data, though, this meeting wasn't to publish a scientific paper or anything like that, correct?
You know, it was set up in my mind the way the presentation was, in that it was, you know, eventually that this information was going to be published.
And it never was.
I have never seen it in print.
That's 5 years ago that this took place.
That's 5 years ago.
And this meeting was set up by lawyers, correct?
It was set up by the UK. They were representing
the claimants.
The claimants, thank you.
The claimants who were alleging that MMR vaccine was causing autism.
Correct.
And does Unigenetics exist anymore?
No, it does not.
And do you know what happened with the litigation in the United Kingdom?
To the best of my knowledge, what I heard was that the judge dismissed the claimants and that we were essentially no longer needed, so do not worry about it. And that anything that related to Unigenetics, I was not aware of until later on. I assumed that they no longer operate because they no longer had a source of support for this activity.
Because the litigation was gone.
That the litigation was gone.
Thank you.
Anything further for this witness, Ms. Chin Kaplan?
No, Special Master.
Anything further?
No.
All right. Dr. Kender, we thank you very much. You're done for this afternoon. Do we have anything else to talk about this afternoon? Is the plan to start with Dr. Byers in the morning?
Yes, sir.
Anything we should talk about before we adjourn for the day?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, we are adjourned for the day then. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for Dr. Byers' testimony.